Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, the things people still get wrong about streaming. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
We're going to take a break from our usual format on this episode because there was one big story last week that has given us a lot to talk about. That being the publication by the Culture Select Committee of the UK Parliament of a big report based on its inquiry into the economics of the music streaming business.
Yeah, it's given us an awful lot to talk about on this week's set list, not least because that report is, now count them, 118 pages long. Although, don't worry, we're not going to go into detail on every single one of those 118 pages, especially not page 118, which was basically a page plugging all the other reports that this committee has published in the last year or so.
Well, at least that's one page we can ignore entirely. So we're down to 117. But yeah, we're going to run through the key findings, tell you what the committee got wrong, and then pose an important question that should probably get answered before anyone instigates a complete reset of the entire music business. A complete reset being what the committee called for.
Yeah, that was the bold statement at the top of the press release put out by the committee alongside this report. And then that, yeah, complete reset line found its way into pretty much every headline of every article on every website reporting on this report, including in the CMU Daily. Although I have to say, in my first draft of my article, not only in the headline, throughout the entire report. Well, I mean, I only mentioned that reset the streaming music business line a couple of times, but all occasions I typed rest instead of reset.
only rest on... the... Well, maybe that is all it needs.
Well, maybe we should just shut it all down. Maybe that is the solution. If we were just to get rid of it all,
well,
there would no longer be. Imagine if the entire streaming music business had to be shut down because of a typo. But fortunately, it was me that made that typo, and we spotted it before we published. It was not in the report itself.
No, I'm sure they proofread it, all 118 pages beforehand. I mean, as did we. We're not going to shut down the entire music business. That is not what this episode is about. Instead, let's quickly run through the main recommendations of a document that the Musicians Union called revolutionary, the MMF and FAC said was a landmark report, and the publication of which the Ivers said marked a great day for musicians and music creators.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that for most artists and songwriters and managers, this was a very welcome report, mainly because it sets out in black and white and therefore legitimizes an assortment of grievances that those artists and songwriters and managers have been shouting about for literally years. And that, of course, was, in essence, the aim when the Musicians Union and the Ivers Academy and, of course, Tom Gray's Broken Record campaign that we must also name check played a very important role here. When they first started campaigning about a year ago, really, for this inquiry to take place, in a way, although the publication of this report is just one step, there's still a lot to be done. But in a way, that's what the MU and Ivers and the Broken Record campaign, it's what they were looking for. They were looking for a group of MPs from across the political spectrum to set out and endorse, in essence, the various complaints that lots of artists and songwriters and managers of artists and songwriters have about the way the streaming music business works.
Yeah, and actually, if you read the submissions made to the inquiry by the MU and the Ivers Academy and the Broken Record campaign, as well as the MMF and FAC, you'll find that most of the things those organisations called for are recommended by the committee in this report.
Yeah, so although you will find some recommendations in the report in amongst those 118 pages about things like the copyright safe harbour and some concerns around sort of the Spotify algorithm, which are topics which pretty much unite the music community. I mean, that's sort of the digital platforms versus the music industry. But it has to be said that many of the recommendations in this report, the majority, and certainly the recommendations that have got the most press, comes straight from the list of demands made by the artist and songwriter and management organisations here in the UK.
And that includes introducing performer equitable remuneration on streams. So rather than the artist's cut of streaming money being dependent on whatever their record or distribution deal says, all performers, including session musicians, would get at least a minimum share automatically through the collective licensing system. It also recommends an investigation by the UK's Competition and Markets Authority into the majors to see if their dominance in both recordings and songs is negatively impacting on the value of songs. Plus, there are calls for a contract adjustment mechanism, a reversion right, and more transparency about royalty chains. Now, you can read more about all of those in our report on the report, on the CMU website, which we'll link to in the show notes. But we thought we might start the podcast by discussing what the report got wrong and what some of the people responding to the report have also got wrong.
Yeah, there's been an awful lot of positivity about this report within the artist and songwriter and management community, and rightly so. There's reasons for that positivity. But here at Setlist, we like to focus on the negative. Should stress, in the main, the things that the report either completely got wrong or kind of got wrong, in my opinion, none of it really has a huge impact on the recommendations. So it's not that we are pulling apart the recommendations by pointing out some factual errors, but we thought it might be worth pointing out those factual errors because, well, maybe some of you are going to this guide in order to understand how the streaming music business works. And I might be a little bit biased, but I think there's another thing you could go to if you want to understand how the streaming music business works. There's a book called Dissecting Digital Dollar. It's actually quoted quite a lot in the report, but I should stress, not in the sections where they got it wrong, because they got it wrong and the book doesn't. So I would say the first thing they got wrong, which, as I say, it doesn't impact on the recommendations really, but there is a section at the start where they seek to set out an explanation of how digital licensing works. And that, as regular listeners to Setlist know, digital licensing is very confusing. And on one level, credit to the MPs, who obviously are not experts on any of this, nor should they be. And a lot of it they did manage to get their head around, and that's an achievement. But they set out how the licensing works of the streaming services, and they correctly identify that in a track, there are both recording rights and song rights, two distinct copyrights, and that the music industry has traditionally managed its recording rights and its song rights separately, which means that streaming services, when they get their licensing deals from the music industry, need to do two sets of deals, one with the record industry around recordings, another with the publishing business around their songs. That is all correct, but it then says that whereas on the recording side, the deals are done by record labels and music distributors, which they are, it then basically said in quite a quick paragraph, on the song side, it all goes through the collective licensing system. So the licenses are done by PRS and MCPS, the two collecting societies on the song side of the UK music industry. Now, that's wrong. It is true that PRS in particular, and MCPS as well, do have a role to play in digital licensing. They are involved. But it's wrong to say that all the licensing on the song side goes through the collective licensing system, because it doesn't. For huge portions of the Anglo-American repertoire, the music publishers actually negotiate the deals. There are complexities because, as we will discuss in a moment, a stream exploits different elements of the copyright, what the music publishing sector traditionally refer to as the mechanical rights and the performing rights. And because a stream exploits the so-called performing rights, PRS does have to be involved. Now, there ain't time today to explain how it works, but the point is that the report basically says, oh, on the song side, it all goes through the collective licensing system. It's nice and simple. It ain't simple. It's a combination of direct deals by music publishers, some deals by collecting societies for some of the repertoire, and then PRS being confusingly involved in the direct deals too. Now, I do realise that had the report got the song side right when it comes to licensing, it probably would have added another 5 pages to the already incredibly long report. But that is a factual error quite early on in this report.
So that's one thing they definitely got wrong. We would also disagree with what they said about how the music industry defines a stream.
Yeah, there's a section in there which discusses how the music industry has chosen to interpret a stream in copyright terms. Now, the report is right to say that there has been lots of debate over the years within the music industry about which elements of the copyright are exploited when music is streamed. Because copyright law itself doesn't talk about streaming. So there isn't that there is a streaming right or a streaming control that comes as part of the copyright. Instead, what copyright law says is, as a copyright owner, you have control over the reproduction of your content, the distribution, the rental of your content, the adaptation of your content, the performance of your content, the communication of your content, and the making available of your content. That is what copyright law says. And so when streaming came along, one interesting question to be had is, okay, when music streams, which of those different controls, those different elements of the copyright are being exploited? Now, you could say, well, who cares? Surely that's just semantics. But actually, it's not just semantics. But where I would disagree with what the report says about how the music industry has defined the stream is it says, oh, well, the record industry and the music publishing sector have come up with different definitions of the stream. They've decided that different bits of the copyright are being exploited on the recording versus the song, and that the record industry reckons that it is the making available control and only the making available control that is being exploited, while on the song side, it's a reproduction and a performance. It's basically what it says. Now, I would say that that's not strictly true. In a way, the music industry has never properly defined a stream. The point is that issues around which controls are being exploited are different on the recording side versus the song side. So on the publishing side of the industry, the different controls are split and grouped. So it's very common, as I've already said, on the publishing side to talk about there being mechanical rights, which would include the reproduction and distribution controls, and performing rights, which would include the performance, communication, and making available controls. And the split is important because by convention in the UK music industry, where a songwriter does a publishing deal, as a result of that deal, the music publisher will own the mechanical rights. They'll be in control of the mechanical rights. But PRS, the collecting society, will always, well, nearly always, be in control of the performing rights. Which means that when streaming came along, we did have to define what a stream was in copyright terms to an extent, because the question was, well, are the mechanical rights being exploited here, in which case the publisher does the deal, or are the performing rights being exploited here, in which case PRS does the deal? The conclusion was both. So mechanical rights are being exploited, performing rights are being exploited, so you're going to need to have a deal that includes publisher rights and PRS rights. So when somebody on the publishing side says, well, the stream is a reproduction and a performance, they don't necessarily mean the performance control. They're kind of saying that to mean it's the performing rights. And it doesn't really matter on the publishing side whether it's performance, communication, or making available, because whichever of those it is, PRS have to be involved, and that's all we need to know. So that's what's happening on the song side. On the recording side, where artists have signed a conventional record deal with a record label, the label has all the controls that come with the copyright. So on one level, on the recording side, it doesn't really matter which controls are being exploited because the label's in control. Except there's this thing called equitable remuneration. And that's a performer right. And so what the law says is when the performance and communication controls are exploited, performers have a statutory right to payment at industry standard rates through the collective licensing system. That's what ER says. So on the recording side of the business, the key question is, well, are the performance and communication controls exploited in a stream? Because if they are, ER needs to be paid. But if they're not, then ER doesn't need to be paid. Which is why on the recording industry side, basically what the labels are saying is, we accept that performing rights are being exploited through a stream, but our point is, it's definitely the making available control. There's no ER on making available, and that's the thing that matters. But that isn't the labels saying, we don't think there's a reproduction going on here. It's not that the labels disagree with the publishers, where the publishers say, no, there's reproduction as well as performing rights. I think the labels would agree with that. The point is, it doesn't really matter on the recording side whether reproduction is involved or not. All that matters is, when it comes to the performing rights element, is it communication or making available? Because that has an impact on ER. So I would say that this idea that there's a really fixed definition of a stream on the recording side and a fixed definition on the publishing side and the definitions are different, that's not strictly true. The point is that when it comes to defining a stream, what matters on the song side is different to what matters on the recording side. But actually, there aren't rigorously fixed definitions anywhere in the industry. And you might think, well, hang on a second, why has Chris just spent so much of Setlist going on about these tedious technicalities? Well, as we shall see in a moment, this is important when it comes to ER.
Yeah, now you've brought up equitable remuneration. That's a third issue with the report. Not so much the report itself, but with people's understanding of what equitable remuneration is and means.
Yeah, so I think it's fair to say that although there's a whole bunch of recommendations in this report, probably the headline-grabbing recommendation, and certainly what the committee themselves chose to lead with in their press release, is the proposal that so-called performer equitable remuneration, or performer ER if you prefer, should now be applied to streams where to date in the UK, and in most countries actually, it has not been. And because that was a recommendation that the committee led with themselves when it came to the press release, a lot of the newspapers and websites reporting on this also led with this idea that equitable remuneration should be applied to streams. And I think sometimes there is some confusion as to what the word equitable means. And to be fair, the report doesn't make this error in itself, although I think there's a couple of paragraphs in the report that people have honed in on that has brought about the confusion. Basically, what a lot of people are saying is, if so-called ER was to be applied to streams, what that means is, of any money that comes in from streaming that is allocated to a sound recording, that money would have to be split 50-50 between the copyright owner, probably a label, and the performers, because equitable means equal.
Yeah, and that's not what equitable means, despite having the same first three letters. But you can't go around saying that all words with the same first three letters have the same meaning. Equitable means fair and impartial rather than split equally, as is being presented in a lot of the coverage of this report.
Yeah, so the key point is that if ER was introduced on streams, and this report is very gung-ho that it should be, that doesn't necessarily mean of the money that is allocated to the recordings each month by streaming services that that's going to be split 50-50 between label and artist. Now, I think one of the reasons why people have leaped to the assumption that it would, aside from possibly a misunderstanding of what the word equitable means, is that the report correctly states that where ER currently exists in the UK, which is when the performance and communication elements of the copyright are exploited, so that would include broadcast and when recorded music is played in public, under the current system where ER applies, the money is split 50-50. Half of the money will go to the copyright owner, often a label, and half will go to the performer, and all of that is administered by the collecting society, PPL. But as the report also notes, if you actually look at UK copyright law, UK copyright law just says that when the performance and communication elements of the sound recording copyright are exploited, performers should get equitable remuneration, full stop. It doesn't actually define what equitable remuneration means. And it's basically the music industry has decided, and the music industries in most countries have made the same decision, that when it comes to money that comes in from radio and from public performance of recorded music, ER applies, and that means we split the money 50-50 between the copyright owner, probably a label, and the artist. But ER by definition doesn't necessarily mean a 50-50 split. And indeed, the report talks about one of the few countries where ER is already paid on streams, which is Spain. So unlike most other countries in the world, it was decided quite some time ago in Spain that there is an ER payment due on a stream. So it's already happening in Spain. But what happens in Spain is that a small portion of the total digital pie each month, I think it's about 2-3%, although no one will go on the record with precise figures on this, but approximately 2-3% of the money that comes in from streaming in Spain each month goes through the collective licensing system through the Performer Society and then is distributed to the performers who appear on the recordings. So that is ER, but it's not 50-50. And then the rest of the money continues to go to labels and distributors who will then pay their artists a royalty subject to contract. So ER doesn't necessarily mean a 50-50 split. Even if it did, even if it was decided that ER in the UK was going to be a 50-50 split, like it is on radio income and public performance income, this is where the definition of the stream becomes really important. Because if the record industry was to say, well, the publishing side of the business has already decided that a stream is both a reproduction and a making available at the same time. And actually, under the UK system, when money comes in, it's split 50-50. Half is allocated to mechanical rights, half to performing rights. If we take that model and apply it to recordings, so reproduction, making available, if we change copyright law so that ER becomes applicable to the making available control as well as the communication and performance control, which is basically what the report recommends, well, okay, maybe there's now ER on streams, but it's not a 50-50 split of the money that comes in for the recordings. It's now 50% of 50%, because the ER only applies to the making available bit, not to the reproduction a bit. So now, actually, the ER is 25%. So the artist is going to get 25% guaranteed under law through the system, and then the other 75% will go to the label, some of which will be the label's share of the making available, and the rest will be allocated to reproduction for the label to then distribute with artists subject to contract. So equitable doesn't necessarily mean equal, it means fair. And I think that brings us to an interesting debate, doesn't it? Because, as I say, it's one of many recommendations, but it is in some ways the headline recommendation, is that we should start paying equitable remuneration on streams so that those artists who are currently getting a really small share of money from streams because of the record deals that they did would be guaranteed a minimum cut of the money through the ER system. That is the big headline-grabbing recommendation in the report. If the government... Now, the government could ignore everything in this report. It is only a parliamentary report. But if the government was to decide to go ahead with that recommendation, then I think the industry and the political community together, we probably do need to have a conversation about, okay, well, if equitable means fair, well, what the hell does fair mean?
Yeah, because it's important to remember that although the report very much recommends that ER should be paid on streams, it doesn't go into any detail about the practicality of that or how it would work. It just calls it a simple yet effective solution.
Yeah, simple yet effective. So that's interesting, isn't it? From Parliament's point of view, if you're an MP, they're right, it is simple. Because as the MU and Tom Gray's Broken Record campaign pointed out in an open letter that they sent to Prime Minister Boris Johnson earlier this year, in order for ER to be due on streams, you just have to make a very slight edit to the Copyright Designs and Patents Act 1988 that at the moment explicitly states that no ER is due when the making available element of the copyright is exploited. We just need to change that to say, actually, when the making available is exploited, ER is due. So from a parliamentary perspective, it is a simple change. But from a logistical, practical perspective, adding ER to streams throws up a whole assortment of tricky questions that need to be answered, including the question, what is fair?
Yeah, and when we talk about what is fair, one of the challenges of that is that really heritage artists and modern artists are in very different positions. And what's fair for the artist and the label for one might not be for the other.
Yeah, so let's take a practical example for a moment. Let's say you're a heritage artist. Let's say you signed to a major label in 1988, and you signed a pretty conventional record deal for the era, which was probably going to pay you as an artist, I don't know, let's say a 12% royalty. So you're on a 12% royalty. And basically what that means is, on a classic record deal, that you get 12% of the wholesale price, or what often is referred to as the PPD in the record industry, you get 12% of the wholesale price of any discs that are sold, okay? Vinyl or CD, I guess 1988 cassettes were probably still part of the business, so not just discs. Any physical product of your music that's sold, the wholesale price. So basically that's what the retailer pays the distributor. So it's not what the fan pays in the record shop. You're on 12% on a 1988 record deal. Except on a 1980s record deal, there's probably also some provisions in the contract that allow the label to make some deductions or to apply some discounts to what you're going to get paid. So, for example, breakage. In the physical era, when record labels sent discs out to record shops, sometimes they got broken in transit. And those CDs, those cassettes, those vinyl records had to be put in the bin. And so the agreement was, well, where we lose stock, both artists and labels should share the cost of that. So we'll apply a little deduction to what the artist receives in order to cover breakage. And then you have international deductions. So you sign to the UK division of a major label, but it turns out that there's an opportunity in the US to sell some records. So an American division of the same company releases the record in the US, but because the American division has to do a load of work in order to get your music out there, any money that comes in, they get to deduct a chunk of that to cover their costs and to reward them for their efforts. And that might be 50% of the money that comes in through the American division. The American division then pays the UK division, but you would usually get your 12% on what the UK division earns. So 50% has already been taken off before your 12% is deducted. Then sometimes there are discounts in the deal. So the label does a really expensive TV advertising campaign around one of your singles. It might be that the deal is, well, if we cover the cost of that ad campaign, we're going to give ourselves a 3% discount whenever we pay you a royalty on that track. So you're starting with a relatively low royalty to begin with, and then there may be other deductions and discounts applied which reduce how much you earn. Plus, on a record deal, as an artist, you usually need to recoup any upfront advance that you receive from the label, and probably some of the other costs involved in releasing the record are recoupable. So that's a classic 1980s record deal, and that's what you signed. Fast forward 20 years. Streaming comes along. And suddenly, those recordings that you made 20 years ago are being streamed, and money's coming in. And if we're being honest, unlike with old-fashioned catalogue exploitation, when a label would have to reissue an album or a track to make more money, with streaming, yeah, the label had to digitise the track, they had to upload it, they had to provide the artwork and the metadata. There wasn't zero work, but there was relatively little work. And suddenly more money's coming in because people are streaming the music, which 20 years earlier, nobody could have anticipated. And yet some of those labels, now there is inconsistency when it comes to what people do in this domain across the industry, but some labels, when they're paying the artists their cut of that streaming income, are basically going to the record contract and saying, well, whatever you earned on the CD, we'll pay you on a stream. So that's 12% minus international deductions, other deductions, plus you're still recouping costs from 20 years ago. And I think most artists, most managers, and most lawyers and accountants who work for artists would say that that doesn't seem fair. It doesn't seem fair that the label is benefiting from this new thing called streaming, catalogs suddenly more lucrative, and yet a deal written in the 1980s, which was designed for the era of selling discs, the terms are being applied to streaming income, which means the artist is getting a tiny slice of the money. I mean, single figure percent probably, once all the deductions are taken into account. And that may still be paying off advances that were received 20 years ago. And that's one of the reasons why you have heritage artists who are getting impressive streaming numbers and just aren't seeing any real return on that. And I would say that's not fair.
Now, as you alluded to, not all record labels choose to interpret old deals like that. And we heard in the inquiry about how Beggars basically just treats all of its old deals as if they're new deals. So it pays a 25% royalty, it doesn't make any deductions on digital, and they write off all unrecouped advances after 15 years. So labels can do things differently to what you just described, but some labels are choosing to interpret old deals exactly as they were written.
Yeah, so if you agree with the heritage artists and their managers and lawyers and accountants who say that the way I've described it seems unfair, well, the question is, well, what can we do about that? And the easiest thing would be for all labels to basically adopt the Beggars model and say, right, we're going to pay a modern royalty across our catalogue, no deductions on any digital income anywhere, and we'll write off unrecouped balances after a period of time. And of course, we should reference, as the report does, that Sony Music recently announced that it was going to do one of those things, which was it was going to pay through royalties to artists on pre-2000 record contracts where they hadn't recouped. So not fully adopting the Beggars approach, but nevertheless moving things in the right direction. If labels won't voluntarily go the Beggars route, well, what else could you do? Well, things that are talked about in the report, which are all based on proposals put forward by various artists, songwriter, manager, trade bodies, you could have this thing called a contract adjustment mechanism, which actually is an idea that was contained in the 2019 European Copyright Directive. The idea being that where circumstances dramatically change, maybe artists should have a right to adjust old contracts. Now, you could argue that the contract adjustment mechanism in the Copyright Directive isn't really designed for what we're talking about here, but in principle, it could potentially be used in that way. Or what about reversion rights? What if, after a certain period of time, the copyright in a recording reverted back to the artist, so the label ceased to be the owner and the artist became the owner of the sound recording rights? If that happened as a matter of course, it would mean that every so often, 20 years is talked about in the report, artists will get their rights back and then they could negotiate a new deal, which is relevant for whatever the modern age looks like. So these are all things that could happen that would overcome this unfair scenario. Or you go the ER route. And advocates of ER on streams would say what's great about ER is it circumvents all those terrible old contracts. Because now artists are being paid at an industry standard rate through the collective licensing system, and what the old contracts say is irrelevant.
So that sounds like equitable remuneration is more equitable than what's currently happening and therefore is more fair. But that's not the only kind of artist deal in the modern world, is it?
Yeah, why don't we take a more recent deal? What if a label signed an artist last year on a 50-50 profit share deal with a 10-year license? And there are plenty of indie labels that do deals like that. And I think most artist managers and artist lawyers would agree that actually in the wider scheme of things, that's a very artist-friendly deal. So what would happen under a 50-50 profit share deal on a 10-year license is the label would get control of the recordings for a decade, and then basically what the label says to the artist is, okay, we'll advance you some money, we'll pay for the recording and the marketing and the release, and let's say we're going to spend, across all of that, 80 grand on getting this record out there. Okay, we're going to do a 50-50 profit share deal. What that means is, once the recordings are out there and money's coming in, the first 80 grand of that money will pay back all of the costs that were incurred. And then as soon as we've got to 80 grand, any money that comes in after that point, we'll split it 50-50. And so the label will look at the spreadsheet and say, okay, if we do this deal, maybe it's going to take 4 or 5 years to make that 80 grand. It's worth remembering that a label of that kind is probably working with a distributor to get the music to market, and the distributor may well be taking, let's say, 20% of the money before it even reaches the label's bank account. So actually, we're going to need 100 grand of money to come in. So there's 80 grand coming into the label's bank account to pay off all of those upfront costs. And then anything that comes in after that, we split that 50-50. And so the label says, okay, it's going to take 4 or 5 years for us to make the 80 grand back, but then we'll have 5 years where we're going to split all the money that comes in from that point onwards 50-50 with the artist. And so that's where we make our profit, because we have got a 10-year license on this recording. That adds up for us as a label. That's going to work. We're happy to go ahead on those terms. But what if ER was suddenly introduced on streams? And what if it was 50-50? So it's a 50-50 split between the copyright owner and the performer. So now the artist is going to get their 50% share directly through the collective licensing system. And the label's going to get the other 50%. Except the label will say, well, hang on a second. The artist is now getting their money direct. So we're only getting half of the money into our bank account. So there's two problems here. First, under our existing model, artist and label were basically sharing the cost of distribution, the 20% the distributor's taking. But now that the artist is automatically getting their 50% through the collective licensing system, does that mean that we've got to saddle all the distribution costs? So we're now getting 30% of the money. Plus, we're still paying off the 80 grand. But we're not getting any of the artist's money into our bank account now. So we can't take that money to pay it. So we've now got to pay off all the 80 grand. Plus, we're only getting 30% of the money. So now, we're not going to go into profit in the 10 years that we have control over these recordings. So our model is screwed. Now, that is based on a specific interpretation of how ER might be implemented. And chances are that's not how ER would be implemented. But nevertheless, that is an example of where the artist is quids in, because they're now getting half of the money through the collective licensing system. They no longer need to help pay off the costs. They no longer have to help pay for distribution. The artist is doing very well, but I don't think you could say that that scenario is fair.
Yeah, now it doesn't seem very equitable from the label side.
Yeah, it feels like the label has been a bit hard done by there. And what if we were to take an example where there was no label? What if we were to take a self-releasing artist who is releasing the music themselves and they're using a DRI distributor like, say, TuneCore, in order to get their music out there, which means that they're paying some upfront distribution costs, but then they're getting 100% of the money. So under the current system, they upload their tracks through TuneCore. TuneCore gets the money from Spotify and passes 100% of the money back to the artist. But under our ER system, half the money would now be coming to the artist through the collective licensing system. Now, you might say, well, why does that matter? The artist is still getting all the money because they're getting half the money with their label hat on and half the money through the collective licensing system as their ER. But there are two issues here. Issue number one is any money that flows through the collective licensing system, even if you've got a good collecting society like PPL here in the UK, the society is clearly going to have to charge an admin fee to administrate those royalties. So I think it's reasonable to suggest that probably the admin fee is going to be at least 10%, certainly initially, because PPL would have a lot of upfront costs to set all of this up. So actually, the artist is losing, well, in total, 5% of the money, 10% of the 50%. So the artist is now worse off. But what if the artist used session musicians on their track? Now, one of the great things about having ER on streams is that session musicians who currently get zero from streaming will get a share of the money. That's one of the great things about ER. Well, it's great if you're a session musician, but what if you're a featured artist who uses session musicians? So let's say you hired some session musicians for your recording sessions. Let's say you paid them at least the minimum rates under musicians union contracts. Maybe you're a nice person and you pay them a little bit more because those minimum rates under the MU deals aren't great. But then maybe you took the artist on tour with you for 6 months and you paid them the going rate for being on tour. So you feel that you gave the session musicians a fair deal and they're not cut into any future royalties on the track. Except under ER, they now are, because of the half of the money that is being allocated to ER, if the current model that applies to radio was applied to streams, a third of that is now going to your session musicians. So now you're losing a little bit of money to PPL for admin fees, and a sixth, more or less, of your streaming income is now going to session musicians who you thought you'd already paid. So the question is that fair?
Now, the good news is it's not up to us on Setlist to decide what's fair, which is just as well because I'm not sure we really have any idea. But clearly, some artists on some record deals, especially heritage artists on old deals that haven't been reworked for the streaming age, are not being treated fairly. We already knew that, and the select committees confirmed that for everyone in black and white. But if ER is the solution to that problem, how do you make sure that whatever ER system you introduce is also fair?
Yeah, and it has to be said, the select committee didn't really consider any of that in either the inquiry and the oral hearings or in the report that they published last week. And to be fair, doing that probably does go beyond the remit of this inquiry. But I think we're right to say that if ER on streams is now seriously on the agenda, especially if we mean ER as in a 50-50 split between label and artist, or to be frank, even a 50% on 50% split like I described earlier, if either of those systems are going to be seriously proposed, then it does feel like a more detailed debate on what is fair and what the impact of such a system would be does still need to happen.
Yeah, and one other possible criticism of the inquiry is that it didn't really get much insight into the newer artists who have had considerable success in the streaming age. So some of them having done very different deals with labels or by setting up their own labels and working with distributors. And we do need a solution to ensure that older artists on older deals are treated more fairly. But there should also be consideration for those newer artists and their businesses.
Now, of course, we should remind everybody that this is a select committee report from the British Parliament. So none of these recommendations are coming from the UK government. So what happens now is that relevant ministers in government have 2 months to respond to this report, although that does include the month of August. Nobody does anything in the month of August, do they? So I'm not sure they'll even meet the 2 month deadline, but in theory, they have 2 months to respond to this report. Now, it could be the government say, we like some of these recommendations. It's unlikely they'll like all of them because there's quite a lot of recommendations in there and some are more complicated than others. But they might say, yeah, that recommendation, we think that's good. You're onto something there. We are going to embrace that as government. Equally, they could say, this is a load of nonsense. We're going to ignore it. Now, given how much positive response there has been to this report amongst the artist and songwriter community, it would be quite brave of the government to turn around and say, we don't buy any of this. I don't think they're going to do that. Although what they could do, and I mean, any government could do this, but especially the current UK government, is they could issue a slightly long, waffly statement saying how important this report is and how these are good recommendations and that we really must consider all of this in more detail. And thank you to the committee and all the people who took part and the British music industry is important, blah, 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 and then do nothing. So that could as yet be the outcome. I mean, as a result of that, given that government does have to respond, and from the artist-songwriter side, obviously, they don't want the government to waffle and then do nothing. So we're going to see a lot of lobbying from all the different sides of this debate within the music community over the next few months. And it will be interesting to see what the government does say. But I think it is fair to say, which I think is probably the message we're trying to get over on this issue of set list, is that with some of the recommendations in particular in this report, they may be good recommendations, they may be great recommendations, they may be brilliant recommendations, but most of these recommendations, including the simple solution that is ER, well, there are still some other questions to be answered that weren't really answered by this inquiry, none of which is to say that any one of these recommendations should be rejected as a result of that, but while yet more debate might seem like a tedious thing that none of us wants, there are definitely some questions that are not answered by this inquiry, which I think do need to be answered. A, if we're going to fix streaming, which was the ambition from the MU and the Ivers side, and B, certainly if we are genuinely proposing a reset of the streaming music business.
Yes, so it remains to be seen how the government responds to this. As you say, they're supposed to respond within 2 months. We'll see if that happens. But that's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. If you want to read up more on this, go and check out the show notes, which will be in your podcast player now or at setlistpodcast.com. In there, there'll be a link to our article on this, which is pretty long, and also the report itself, which is much, much longer. We'll also link to those two shows we put out last year on the things people get wrong about streaming, if you haven't listened to those before, because I think they still give a pretty good overview of how streaming works. And as always, there will be a blatant plug for the Dissecting the Digital Dollar book. So you can click through and buy that.
Yeah, and get an accurate description of how digital licensing works. Buy the book for that.
Yes, but beyond that, to get all of our future episodes delivered to your device of choice automatically, you can subscribe to the show in whatever app you're listening to us in now. You can rate us and review us. That's very helpful. You can also email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Moult and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.